From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection this hour was made with a young woman, 23 years old, who was feeling burned out. Joelle Moore found herself tired of seeing politics on her social media feed. She stopped clicking on articles that people were sharing. She wouldn't watch videos. She decided she didn't want to talk politics with friends or family anymore. And she told the Wall Street Journal, "It is burnout for a lot of us. Sometimes the news can be really heavy." Here's how the Wall Street Journal writes about the way many people are feeling this election season. Quote, "In a heated election season with global conflicts intensifying, news abounds, and some Americans are now avoiding it at all costs. They are canceling subscriptions, deleting apps, silencing notifications, and unfollowing rabble-rousers. Political discourse has infiltrated everything from the Sunday church service to afternoon football, and they have had enough. Even those with firm political views say they feign ignorance rather than join impassioned discussions. It isn't, they say, that they are uninterested or uncaring about world events, but they are inundated by the sheer volume of news headlines. Deciding it is bad for their mental health, they are retreating or seeking apolitical havens," end quote. In Rochester, the Center for Dispute Settlement is trying to help. It's not the CDS thinks that everyone should talk about politics all the time. It's that our capacity for empathy seems to be eroding. Our capacity to listen, to see one another as human beings is flickering. And how do you feel about the next 8 days? Probably a lot of anxiety. So the center has launched a series of programs offering guidance for all of us. The old cliche is that Americans dread Thanksgiving. We dread having those conversations across the Thanksgiving table. Well, now many of us are wondering, are we going to make it to Thanksgiving? I'm here to tell you that we are, but we're going to talk about how we can kind of have a different kind of discourse this hour. And Dr. Shira May is the one who reached out to me. Shira is the president and CEO of the Center for Dispute Settlement. We're going to try to model something a little different this hour.
We're going to try.
How are you?
I am hanging in. Like you said, we have anxiety all around us, and I'm not escaping from it, but I'm hanging in there, and I'm glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. Kim Reich is the director of Ontario Yates Counties for the Center for Dispute Settlement. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Welcome as well to Jermani Dozier, director of the Center for Employment Opportunities in Rochester. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Dr. Milo Oberon. Milo is professor and chair of the Women and Gender Studies Department at SUNY Brockport. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You know, Shira, a lot of people listening right now are thinking about the next 8 days, but they're also probably thinking about the next 15 days. What's the week after the election going to be like? What's the month? How are we going to deal with whatever happens?
Yeah.
And tell me why you wanted to reach out and have this conversation now in particular.
Yeah, I think that the primary emotion that I'm seeing people come to me with, and this is on our staff, our clients, our community partners, is anxiety and fear. I just did a workshop called Scary Conversations because that's how it feels. People are feeling full of really terror at all the different potential futures that we could see happen, right? There's imaginary scenarios playing out in our minds, and those fears and anxieties are coming with us to work. They're coming with us to the dinner table, to holiday gatherings. I was thinking scary conversations because it's Halloween, but that's how people are feeling. And I think that what we want to do is let people know you don't have to do this alone. There are resources out there. Come talk to us and come to one of our classes because we want to help people learn how we can do our best to kind of maintain our composure, take good care of ourselves, but also have more effective and productive conversations.
Kim, how are you feeling these days?
Anxiety would be the word. Anxious, I guess. There's just a lot for people right now. And as a mediator, I'm used to sitting with people in conflict all the time. But this feels like almost free-floating kind of anxiety and helplessness. And I'm really appreciating that people need to find space where they can have a conversation with people that they may be disagreeing with. And so we're trying to figure out some ways that we can be helpful.
Jermani, how are you feeling?
Also a bit of anxiety. I hear a lot where individuals are, you know, anxious about the unknowns. And I think for a lot of people that, you know, puts them on edge, not knowing what the future will hold. So for me, it's, you know, how do we deal with those conflicts in the midst of all that is going on currently?
Dr. Oberon.
Yeah, so coming from the perspective of working on a college campus, I think it's interesting how often campuses are like sites for conflict and debate, and it's often one of the places we see the expression of people's opinions. And just talking to students recently, many of them have said, well, I'm not seeing conflict on campus. I don't really even, you know, they express that they love that there's a, you know, very active voting drive, but that there's not a lot of actual conflict or even conversation. And they use the word anxiety frequently. Sometimes it's about their own futures and what it might mean, what the election might mean for them personally. But there's, you know, students have also shared when they go home, whether it's to their, you know, their roommates or their family, that's where they really feel the silence more intensely. And so it's on the campus, they at least have the space of the classroom to have some conversations. Yeah. And when they go back to their personal lives, that anxiety kind of takes over and they really shut down around people that otherwise they would, you know, have intimate relationships with.
Well, and Dr. Obern, I after Shira reached out, I've been reading a lot about anxiety discourse, how people are managing. And, you know, I referenced the Wall Street Journal article. It was one of many that I was reading. What stood out to me there was this idea that younger people especially are feeling that anxiety and starting in larger numbers to tune out, which I don't think is a healthy, let me put it this way, in an ideal scenario, we're approaching a national election and people should be engaged. They should be passionate if they choose to learn more and to invest a lot of time and energy in ways that are productive, in ways that aren't fearful, in ways that are respectful. And yet most of the passions feel differently. And younger voters who may be voting for the first time or considering voting for the first time are feeling that in really dark ways. And that does not help with their decision to vote, perhaps, the decision to even talk about it, even if they want to. And there to me is something very different about, are you engaged? Because I think a lot of people are, especially young people, college students, I mean, as yeah. you say. But it's this feeling of like, this is like an electric wire that went down. I'm not going to touch it.
I think so. And this is anecdotal. And the students that I work with tend to be very politically engaged.
Yeah, sure.
So they're passionate students and they have strong opinions. And most students I talk to say that they are definitely voting and, you know, many of them voting for the first time. And they don't necessarily want to engage in these conversations outside of the people that they kind of already know agree with them to some extent, mm-hmm. or like a classroom space that's been made safe through shared working agreements or something like that, that there is that sense of like live wire outside of what they know. So they can still be engaged and passionate, but that's not being translated necessarily into conversations across different opinions.
Yeah. Jeremiah, how do you feel about this idea that even when people want to feel engaged, it almost feels like it's not worth it, whatever space you're in?
Yeah, I think there's back to the fear of the unknown, but I think it's important for individuals to realize that your voice is important. Conflict, even if it brings up conflict can also be a positive thing, right? To understanding different individuals' views, where they come from, to help them make that decision. But I think silencing your voice, if it calls conflict or not, is not the answer. So,
yeah. What do you think, Kim?
I think for a lot of people, conflict feels dangerous, right? And it feels really disruptive. And when we're in that kind of space, our brains have us living kind of what I call our lizard brain. So we're all just kind of like trying to defend ourselves. We are bigger, we're louder, or we're running the other way. And so I think when people are in that space, they can't access the parts of themselves, the better parts of their brains, their problem solving, their thinking, their empathy. They can't do that because they're really defended. So I think the work that we do particularly is really focused on trying to give people a setting where they can start to calm their brains. And it seems kind of silly, but that's so that then the rest of the thinking part of their brain can take over and they can start to have a different relationship with people, get more access into what they want, what they need. And parts of the ways you do that through your own interactions with them by listening really deeply if you can, offering people the chance to really express what they're feeling without responding immediately. But then you really have to catch yourself. So I would say the hardest part about these conversations around political ones is that I have political opinions, like most people. And to suspend that for myself among people I love and care about is actually really tricky, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part that's important for us to learn how to do, is to learn how to calm and recenter ourselves and be able to listen with curiosity.
Well, on that point, what makes me feel inauthentic or uncomfortable is when I'm trying to figure out in advance, if I'm having a conversation like, oh boy, what do I think this person's politics are and can I talk about this? Or, mm-hmm. you know, and then you start to feel like you're kind of placating or you're censoring yourself. Mm-hmm. And, but I think a lot of people can relate to that, just feeling like, all right, there's a neighbor and hey, how's it going? Walking the dog. Like I'm not saying anything, you know, mm-hmm. Because I don't know. And I don't think it was always that way. I mean, I don't want to be like that. It's like, well, when I was growing up, everyone was like, oh, there was never any conflict. But it certainly feels more fraught now.
Yeah, I think it's more fraught because there's this immediacy to all of this. Social media has brought us a lot of really good stuff, but also a lot of things that can trigger a lot of strong emotions. And as humans, our brains, we're wired to see the negative, right? It's self-protective for us. We want to be aware of any impending danger. So because of that, I think that we're really susceptible to negative messaging. So lots of negative messaging from wherever it's coming from is going to like stimulate our brains. We're going to get those lovely, you know, those hits to our brains to say, whoa, time to go, let's move. And so when we do that, I think it really sets us into this kind of accelerated state where we really can't calm ourselves. So I think trying to create spaces where people can have more nuanced dialogue and get into a more settled state is a really important part of being able to have those conversations.
I think, too, to add to that, and Kim is our basic mediation trainer, so she trains cohorts of mediators and also does conflict resolution trainings across our community. So this is really good content that I want people to know we offer. We don't see a lot of models of dialogue, right? When we watch TV, we're seeing debates, we're seeing vilifying people, we're seeing, I'm going to win this conversation, I'm going to cut you off, et cetera. But there is such a thing as a dialogue, which is not to convince, it's not to try to be right. And we do have this impulse to try to fix it because the stakes are so high. If only I could convince my grandma to vote mm-hmm. the way I'm voting. But if we can let that go and kind of suspend that and think about just the connection, just the relationship, we don't have to agree to have a dialogue. It can be saying, I never heard you say that before. Thanks for letting me know what's on your mind about that. I didn't realize where that came from. Now I know something more about you. And a little tip I like to use is to ask permission. So I might say, I wonder if you'd be open to hearing my perspective. I'm a little nervous to say it, but I really want you to know where I'm coming from. And usually people are not going to say no to that. So it's these dialogue skills that we don't learn in school. You know, we don't see models of, but they really do make a difference. And people say once they learn these skills, they just feel more effective in themselves. And they feel like they learned something, even if they didn't convince.
Well, the word conflict has already come up. How do you define conflict, Shira?
Well, we think of conflict as a natural part of being a human being. Being in relationships means that we're going to have these interactions that don't feel good. We really define conflict very broadly as it's like a crisis in human interaction, which just means the relationship's not going well, the interactions aren't going nowhere, and we can have this downward negative conflict spiral. Kim's going to jump in and correct me if I get any of this theory wrong. But then there are ways to interrupt that spiral and move toward a more positive, constructive ways of interacting. And we do that with, I'm going to say it, but I'm going to turn it over to Kim. The two principles we really lean into are empowerment. When you feel empowered, you're not as likely to be defensive and attacking, right? You can just speak your mind. I'm just telling you how I feel. And the second one is this relatedness or recognizing the other, to recognize there is a different perspective. My perspective is not the be-all, end-all.
Yeah. Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'm going to say that the way we mediate and a lot of the dialogue processes we offer are really working on this kind of relational approach, that humans are hardwired to both be autonomous individuals. We only have one body. We only have one set of senses. We're going to react that way. But the other piece is that we also can't survive alone. Babies don't raise themselves. So we have this tremendous need to both be autonomous and connected. And those things are in tension all the time. So conflict to me is when those two rub up against each other and you end up in kind of a negative space. Sometimes conflict can be positive. Like if you have a really good, strong team working together and really hammering ideas, it can be wonderful. But when it gets negative, when people are feeling like weak and self-absorbed and feeling the need to defend themselves, and then they're going to demonize the other. They don't see humans on the other side of the table. They see bears coming to eat them or tigers after them. They're not human. And that dehumanizing stuff is the really destructive parts of conflict. And so everything we do, we want to figure out ways to help people rebuild those relationships by getting clear in themselves.
And again, it's not about being nice, right? It's not about just agreeing to get along. It's really about being effective at communicating in a way that is most likely the other person can hear you and seeing something new about the other person that can help you actually just connect.
I'm already seeing some emails, and so I should mention, listeners, as we talk about the way we're all sort of feeling and working through how to have productive conversations, maybe bring anxiety down, have a better discourse. It's 844-295-TALK if you want to join the conversation and share your experience. 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Don't call, just yell at me. Actually, you can. That's fine. I mean, that's part of the job. People email to yell at me all the time.
That happens to us, too.
That's okay. It's part of the job. And you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Sarah emailed to say that kids are learning some bad lessons in this election season. And I'm thinking about, so let me start with Sarah's email. I'll get Steve's email in a second. I've got a small handful already. But let me start with Sarah's point about kids, because she's not elaborating, but here's what it made me think of. I want to ask all of you about this. So 1992, I was in eighth grade, and for our big school assembly on the presidential debate, I was selected to play Ross Perot in the debate. And I remember—
Do you have a tape of it?
I don't have a tape of it. I do not. But I studied Perot, I mean, like as an eighth grader would, right? And I thought he was interesting. And I remember my friend Jenna was playing George H.W. Bush. I don't remember which classmate played Clinton. But I remember, you know, having a lot of fun with that. I remember trying to learn as much as I could about this candidate. I remember trying to rep them in this debate where moderators were asking us questions. And, you know, I kind of got a little bit more invested in it. It was interesting. And I wasn't all that wrapped up as an eighth grader in the outcome. I didn't feel like it was existential. I just bring up this story because what I remember most was I thought it was interesting. I thought it was good, cool to learn about. Whether I would have voted for Perot or not, or Bush or Clinton, as an eighth grader, I thought it was interesting. I did not feel the anxiety of like, oh my gosh, my parents can't even talk to our neighbors, or some of our family members look like they want to punch each other. And like, that did not occur to me whatsoever. Was there some of that? Probably. I mean, there's always some political passion. But I don't think kids writ large in 1992 were feeling like, oh, well, this is existential stakes here. And now they're hearing it. Like, that's what they hear, whether it's from neighbors or candidates or whatever. And so I'm thinking about what Sarah says. Kids are learning some bad lessons. And Sarah, I don't necessarily disagree. I don't want to be Pollyanna. Like, let's go back to 1992 when there were no problems. But I do want to understand that if you are feeling anxiety, how do you think an 8-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 16-year-old is feeling watching this play out? And maybe wanting to learn more, but a little scared to. And I'm thinking about that. Let me go around the table. Dr. Oberon, what do you make of Sarah's point there?
Oh, man, you have to start with me. well, I mean, I think I want to first say, you know, it depends on who you are and where you are and what your circumstances are as a child. And I'm sure there were children in 1992 that were feeling, either that it didn't matter at all who, you know, was elected because they, you know, their circumstances weren't going to change, or that it was, you know, that it was really important for their families in some way. So I think, but I take your point and Sarah's, which is just, and we keep talking about anxiety, and Kim, you were talking about kind of trying to find a place where people can kind of calm down. And I think what's connecting this conversation is it is so hard to find a place where you can escape anxiety right now, right? That it's just, it feels like it is infiltrating everywhere, which doesn't mean that it wasn't in some ways, you know, all along. But there is something different about the ways that, at least I'll sort of say from my perspective, about the ways that students are talking about their feelings and interactions, you know, at this moment. So I don't know. I guess I'm curious what the bad lesson is, if it's just that, because there is, it is important. I mean, I don't think that having young people feel like the way that our society functions and who's in power is not important.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I wouldn't want, but as we're saying, if the central feeling around that is anxiety, that's not going to help them to engage or feel empowered in it. So maybe it's a question of empowerment. And I, you know, I think back to, again, what some of my current students are saying is that they're really attaching to the push to get people to vote, and that that may be where they're feeling, you know, that that connection. And then I'll just say, kind of on a personal level, it is very hard to talk to children. I have children, and I am a queer person. I'm a trans person. I'm a, you know, professor of women and gender studies. These, you know, this election will matter to us and our family. And I think it's important to let kids know that that's true without putting it on, you know, putting it on them in some way. And I don't really know what the answer is to that.
Yeah. And Milo, part of where my mind goes in Sarah's email about bad lessons kids are learning, I'm trying to remember Megan Mack. There's a superintendent I'm going to reference and see if you remember the story, because I think the superintendent said this on the air. It's a local Rochester area superintendent who in 2016, after that election, told me that in those following months in that school year, he had never seen, he's since retired, by the way, he had never seen students more almost gleeful to bully others and to attack. And it was almost like this big green light had happened where your worst impulses to belittle, to put down, to bully were made more normalized or okay. And that's one of, and that, by the way, that superintendent, I think, said that on the air. I'm not going to mention their name unless Megan said, oh, yeah, he said that on the air. Do you remember who that was? Okay, yeah. Okay, I want to mention the name if it's if I'm speaking out of school. He wasn't the only one in a school setting who told me that back in 2016. And what I'm wondering now is, are kids learning that politics doesn't mean having civil but difficult conversations, trying to solve problems, sometimes finding consensus, persuading others, and what it means is joining a team and trying to run people over? That's what I'm worried about.
Yes. I hear what you're saying there. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to add one perspective, which is a reflection on the 2016 election also, because I happened to be serving as our interim diversity officer at that time. And so I felt like I was getting a lot of the immediate fallout. And this is a different age group. So I think the superintendent was probably somewhere K through 12. But the number of students who became politically aware and engaged because of that election was also quite high. And students who immediately, and young people I'm mostly talking about there, we have students of all ages, but primarily I think these were younger people who were, had this feeling of like, wow, that this matters. This matters to me. And the decisions that people are making in terms of voting for our leaders have something to do really with me personally and my future. And then took that as a way to kind of think about, okay, well, historically, this, again, this has kind of always been true. Is there a way to frame it as empowering for students to understand that this matters? But that takes this kind of work. And I will say one last thing and then, you know, pass it along. But one of the things that Brockport is doing with the Center for Dispute Settlement is working on restorative practices on campus. And I think taking that step back maybe to think about how can we really work on creating these spaces more intentionally so that whatever way that students react to an election isn't so much reactionary as, you know, it is coming into a container that's already there to kind of hold the feelings and experiences that they're having in relationship to it.
Let me turn to Jarmani Dozier, okay, if you want to wait on this too.
Yeah. For me, I think it's about messaging. We live in a world where social media is on a all high, you know, where messaging has been put out there, and our kids are on these social media sites as well. Also, conversations we're having in our home as adults, they hear it. So I think they realize the stake, even about the election, but also the effect that it can have on their long-term life. So I see more interest as well, even from my 16-year-old daughter. But I think it's about creating the spaces, back to Dr. May and Kim's point, for individuals to feel heard, to feel valued and supported. And if we create those spaces, I think the messaging that will then go out to our kids is that you can have a conflict or some anxiety, but there's space where you can also discuss it and come to some resolution, to move forward together. So.
Okay. Kim, you want to weigh in on that too? Kim Reich is director of Ontario Yates Counties for the Center for Dispute Settlement.
Yeah, I think for kids, I'm with Germani that, they feel it in the air. And schools will tell you that since COVID, big issues with social emotional needs and kids not knowing how to manage. And I think that dealing with social media, that's a whole nother show, I think. Maybe you've already had multiples on this, I think. So I do think that there is an aspect of social media kind of contributing to this. Mm-hmm. But I also think that for managing conflict, I don't think we learn how to do that, right? Like, we either grow up in a family where conflict is avoided, mm-hmm. or where it's avoided until it explodes, or we just don't talk about things. So I don't think this culture, we have a really good, solid history of figuring out how to have hard conversations. And because we don't, when we get hit with these kind of overwhelming anxiety kind of situations, we don't know what to do. And so we demonize, we protect ourselves, we get ourselves in our silos. And I think kids know that too, right? They have less sophisticated brains, they're still learning, they're totally awash in everything the adults are doing. So yes, I agree that kids are learning from us, but I also know that kids pick up these practices much faster than the adults. So having people in schools who are doing community building circles, who are trying to build relationship with peers, to which then reduces bullying, which allows people to tell their authentic stories. Because the other thing is that we're not talking about doing conflict just so that people don't say what's true for them. We want to create spaces where people get to be their authentic selves and speak their truth. And then from that, once that storytelling kind of comes front and center and people understand they have these things in common, then they can start to maybe not agree on the substance, but they at least can see it's not a tiger or a bear or a monster out for them. It's another human who also has some similar values. So I do think that we can model it for kids. And I'm seeing some of the schools, as they move into restorative practice, starting to create spaces for those kind of conversations.
Dr. May?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the need that kids have to learn from the adults in their lives. Just echoing what's been said, I think the silence that kids experience is very loud, and especially when it comes to maintaining relationships. We see articles coming out that people's family relationships are ending at higher rates because of political differences. There is something about people are not dating across the political divide, mm-hmm. and people are making it very personal, right? You're either with me or you're against me. I can't talk to my neighbors, and kids pick up on that. I think that what we hope is that kids can see examples of what it looks like to sit in that uncomfortable place, but with support. I always talk about there's a choice. You don't have to engage in dialogue across political differences. It is hard work, and if you're going to be, triggered or it's going to harm you, then don't do it. But there are ways to do it with support. It tends to be easier in groups. It tends to be easier when you have somebody sitting next to you who's kind of your ally, and so you can look over and make eye contact and have conversations. And I would love to see programming in schools and colleges where kids and young adults are just seeing models of that. I have to tell a silly story. I wasn't going to tell it, but I have to tell it. I was asked out on a date by someone who identifies as a Republican and was telling me that that they don't usually get to go on dates with people from different political beliefs. And we just had a conversation about why that is, and that, you know, his perspective was people are very fearful about losing their sense of self in a relationship. And I think that goes across all kinds of relationships with your family members, if you're dating. But there actually are interpolitical couples out there, and what they do is they focus on the relationship and that they are whole in and of themselves and don't have to change their partner. And they actually grow and expand from that experience. So it was a really fascinating conversation. Mm.
I have this idea that a lot of the work of seeing each other as human beings has become more difficult because we are so much more ideologically divided. Mm. Listeners might have heard this before, but I'll tell you what's one of the things on my mind in the next week. I'm going to be very curious to see what the numbers eventually bear out in terms of how many Americans are now living in landslide counties. Because when Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976, just under a quarter of Americans lived in a landslide county, which means a 20-point margin or more in the presidential race in your county. Mm. When Donald Trump was elected in 2016, it was 60%. It had more than doubled the amount of Americans living in landslide counties, which means you were more likely living with very few neighbors, if any, who disagreed with you. And that number is only moving in that direction. So we're not only sort of self-sorting in a lot of different ways, but ideologically we're self-sorting, and entire neighborhoods and entire streets. And sometimes it feels like you drive through a town, even though it's not true. There's people, there are Republicans in cities, and there's Democrats in the rural areas. Of course there are. But it feels more isolated. Mm-hmm. I only bring that up now because talking is one thing, and in a moment I'm going to ask Dr. May to tell you about classes and resources that are out there from CDS or others. But another is just to realize that the people who you thought you might have to loathe are actually pretty cool. Like, they're pretty good neighbors. They're going to plow at your driveway, or, you know, walk your dog when you're gone, or grab your mail for you, or coach your kids, and all the things that show you that human beings care about each other. It's easier when we're among each other and then go, oh, I didn't know they vote that way. Well, that's a good dude. You know, okay, we're a little different that way, but that's a good dude. And instead, it's like you almost never see somebody who votes differently in many places now. And it's easy to be like, well, I wonder what terrible things they do with all their free time, as opposed to like probably just what you do. That worries me. But apart from that, now that we're all self-sorted away from each other, we do need these classes. We do need these resources. And we do have to learn how to talk to each other a little bit better. Shira, what is out there from the Center for Dispute Settlement for classes, resources, et cetera, that you want people to know about?
Yeah, so we regularly offer mediation training. So those are offered twice a year for folks who want to actually develop that full skill set. It's a commitment to sit in that training, but I think it's a transformative training. People come away really kind of, they're like, oh, I'm going to practice with everyone in my life. We just also have some open to the public workshops that you can find on our website. And then we really try to work with organizations over a long period of time to kind of establish a goal for a team, for example, if it's a workplace team or a campus team on campus, to really change the culture of how we have conversations with one another, both proactively. So how do we get to know each other and build relationships? Like you said, have a meal with somebody who you might not ever have spoken with, all the way to how do we have hard conversations and normalize that we're going to sit down and sit in that discomfort, sit in that place of, oh, this is really hard. I don't know if I can even sit in this chair. And I'll tell you, I work with this one team. We've had 4 circles over the course of 2 months. And from at the very beginning, I had people with their arms crossed, couldn't make eye contact with one another. They're like, why am I here? This is so uncomfortable. And now those folks are just talking. They're opening up. They're sharing with each other, you know, how they got to the beliefs that they have, you know, where their life path has taken them. And you see these real human connections. And in that space, there's growth and learning. And people will say, I never knew that before. I never heard you say that. Do you have something I can read about that? That kind of conversation does not happen without the trust and relationship. So you can find on our website, fill out a form to contact us, drop into one of our offerings. We really want to partner and make more connections.
After we take this only break of the hour, I'm going to get back to your emails. A lot of questions, comments about empathy when people are feeling really frustrated and We're going to hit some of those topics on the other side of this break. Really, really important conversation as we're 8 days away from Election Day. And a lot of us are feeling either anxiety or frustrated and sometimes struggling to talk to each other like we're all human beings. Dr. Shira May is president and CEO of the Center for Dispute Settlement. Kim Reich, director of Ontario Yates Counties for CDS. Jermani Dozier, director of the Center for Employment Opportunities in Rochester. Dr. Milo Oberon, professor and chair of the Women and Gender Studies Department at SUNY Brockport. We're right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a failing grade for Governor Kathy Hochul from an organization called Climate Can't Wait. It's a group that pulls together many, really many different groups that work on climate action, and they've got 14 different grading categories. Governor Hochul gets a D-minus overall. They called him a failing D-minus. Her best score in any category was a C. Why? They'll tell us next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Stephen writes to say, Evan, thanks for tackling this topic. This is something I've really struggled with. It is so hard to treat friends, family members, and acquaintances with care when they support a candidate whom I consider to be fascist and dangerous. It's hard also to have respect for someone who would support someone like that, which is fundamental for friendship and care. And I'm looking forward to any ideas your panel has. He's struggling, Stephen says. Thank you for the email. Shira May, you're going to start with this one.
I'm on the hot seat for that. So this is something we come across in our work across all different kinds of topics, whether it's political differences or when we're talking about anti-racism efforts or any kind of hard issue. We have folks who will say, you have just crossed a line that is beyond my ethics. I can't tolerate that. You know, you've personally harmed me with your belief system. And I think I like the principle of safety first, number one. So if it would be harmful to you to engage in dialogue, you know, and it's a trigger for trauma, if you're a part of a targeted community and you've just been experiencing microaggressions all day long, then don't. Don't engage because your health and well-being is first and foremost. I think that actually the point of empowerment, self-empowerment, is for people to take care of themselves and know when they're, you know, capable, have the capacity to engage in hard conversations, when they could do it with a support person, so maybe a mediator or an ally or somebody like that, and when they can't, but they can tap somebody else to have that conversation with them. What I think we hope people know is that you don't have to do nothing. You don't have to avoid the situation. You can take action, but it doesn't have to be you that's facing that hard conversation. I will say that for me, you know, I've been able to kind of build my assertiveness skills. And sometimes it sounds like, you know, when you use that language or when you insinuate this, I'm really not feeling safe in the conversation. To me, this is crossing a line for me that doesn't feel safe right now. And if they're open to hearing that, that's how you can explain what the impact is on you. And if they're not open to hearing that, I would say, you know, we don't expect to squeeze blood out of a stone. Is that how the expression goes? I don't know expressions very well. But you can't, right? You can't cross a line if it's not both ways. Well, I think what's important is if you are going to express yourself, to make sure you're doing it effectively. I coach people to think about what their values are and how they've been impacted. John and Julie Gottman are a couple that teach communication skills, and they say, describe yourself. Mm. So instead of saying you're a fascist and you're ruining our society, you can say, I am terrified when I think about what might happen if my child, you know, experiences XYZ. I really feel fear, and what I'd like to see is a world where this is how it looks like for my child. That's a really different way of engaging in dialogue than saying, you're wrong, you don't know what you're talking about. So those are the ways I would approach it.
Yeah, Kim, one of the few skills I have hopefully developed a little bit of is trying to understand how belief development forms. Mm-hmm. And it's not a linear straight line for everybody, but there are very few people who, I think a guest recently put it better than I've ever put it, which is most people are not twirling their mad scientist mustache at the end of the day going, ha ha, got away with it. The way I've always put it is most people are not going to bed at night thinking that they're on the wrong side of history, but they're mm-hmm. getting away with it. Mm-hmm. Most people believe mm-hmm. for reasons that may be hard for some people to understand, but most people do believe that they've got the best information and they're doing the right thing with it. I do think I invoke Molly Ivins a lot, late columnist who used to write a lot about how even though she was on the political left, she had a lot of affection for voters on the right because she said, my ideological opposition is not to you. It's people in power who manipulate you. So her ire was directed at people at the top who controlled a lot of the wealth, the power, and not at rank and file Americans who may, you know, be arriving at conclusions she thought were wild or not right, but are still nonetheless exposed to what they're exposed to and getting there intellectually honestly. And then she would start every conversation by saying, I don't think you're a bad person. I don't think you think you're a bad person. I think we disagree very strongly about certain things, and I want to know how you got there. Like, mm-hmm. tell me how you formed this belief, mm-hmm. as opposed to, like, your belief is bad. Mm-hmm. How did you form that belief? Like, what's the evidence that you're basing it on? What would it take to change your mind? What's something that you could hear that would actually move you? Yeah. And then then you can ask me the same, and I'll tell you what it would take to move me. Mm-hmm. That's very different than, hey, your Facebook post sucks, and I did not know that you're bad. Yeah. You know, so, and I hope that you, you know, get some food poisoning. I don't know. I mean, like, people say terrible things. So how do you start that?
So first I have to start by taking care of myself, because I will say there are family members I don't talk politics with.
Just not worth the investment.
Too concerned that I'm not going to show up the way I want to show up.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? Because I know.
It affects you in a way.
Right. Because I wouldn't care, right? Like, I mean, I can feel my anxiety about this and other people too. So it's not that we don't care. It's that we care so much sometimes that we want to not damage the relationship. So we have a tendency to not even have the conversation. So I do think the first thing I need to do if I'm going to do that is to make sure that I'm in a space where I can do that, right? This idea of being able to be in a place where I can do what Molly Evans suggests, which is to be curious, right? Ted Lasso's quote, right? Be curious, not judgmental. I cannot tell you how many times I use that quote and how many times I say it to myself on a daily basis, because if I'm judgmental, I think I know, right? I have the right answer and you are wrong. Whereas if I'm curious, I'm in a space of wondering, what's going on for you? How did you get there, right? And if I can get my brain into that space before I have that conversation, I stand a much better chance of finding at least something like Shira's wonderful words. Because when I'm in conflict, it is not pretty, just to be clear, right? I don't always have the best words. So I will often just avoid the conflict. So I think that for me, a big part of this is getting a better handle on myself, being able to regulate myself and to stay curious. So if I can do that, for me, that's really helpful. And I will say Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, is a really helpful book for anyone who wants to read about the differences in the political divide and how that lands with values. We all have the same values. We just lean into different values more strongly than others. And that's how we get here at some level. We all believe in respect. We all believe in dignity. We all believe in choice and freedom and love and all of those things. But which ones we lean into in certain situations changes. So
The author that she's referring to, Haidt.
Ght, I think. Dt. Oh, no, you're right.
I think it's Dt. That's someone who I'd love to have on this program in the future.
Yeah.
But one other note on that. I think it's so interesting that you recognize in yourself that you don't love the way that you show up, that you don't mm-hmm. always feel like I'm following my values when my emotions get going in these conversations. And it's not the – so – but when I hear you say, like, you know – instead of saying, I'm right, you're wrong, frame it in a different way. You know, like, help me understand how you got here. I want to understand that. Can it be both? Where I'll give you an example. Listeners know how I feel about the peaceful transfer of power in this country and how dangerous it is to set a precedent that we're not doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. That we, for the first time ever in 2021, didn't have one. Didn't have a candidate who agreed to one. And people died because of it, and it could get a lot worse. It would take a high bar for me to change that view. There's no belief that I hold that could never be changed. Some bars are so high that it's hard to imagine, but I'll open the door to anything with a certain amount of evidence. Having said that, I believe very strongly that this is wrong. Mm-hmm. To support the notion that if my side wins, it's fair, mm-hmm. and if my side loses, it's rigged, mm-hmm. is what children do, and children have to learn how to regulate that, and if we do that, we're in real trouble. But I do want to know why average Americans mm-hmm. don't have the same concern that I have about that. So can it be both where I say, I think I am right on this, but I want to know why you don't feel the same way. Like, yeah. I do care about that. I'm not trying to demean you. I want to know why you feel that way.
I think the key is to how non-judgmentally I can come across, right?
Yeah,
for me, it's partly about if I'm capable of listening to understand. And that's why when I hold space as a mediator or when I'm sitting in a circle with people who are having a hard conversation, I can just be present with that, suspend my own stuff to some degree, be aware of my own stuff to another level. And then when I'm staying present, I can really kind of respond to them as a human, not as an escalated human in my lizard brain trying to protect myself. So that key, that's the tricky part, and it takes skill. And there are some things that you need to take action on. This is not to say that people should not take action, right, when they feel like something wrong has happened.
Sure.
Right? People need to be able to, but they also want to be able to justify and explain why they're doing what they're doing. And so sometimes it's very helpful to connect to the humans and say, I love my country as much as you do. Right? And I think we can be better. So what's wrong with that, right? It's what I tell my children. It's what I tell myself in the morning. So I can both love my country and disagree with you. So can we have that conversation? And some days we can. Some days I don't have it in me to do that. And that's okay. Like, we're not asking everyone to just go out and have these random political conversations with the person standing behind you in the checkout line. But for the people who matter most to you, the ones who you're distancing yourself from because these conversations feel so fraught, is to come at them differently, come at them with, like, understanding, like seeking to understand. And then you don't have to change your mind at all. You don't. It's your choice. But you might be able to at least have insight into which values are they leaning into. What's the thing that's really important for them?
Yeah, I really love how you talked about that, Kim, is like, are you showing up with a genuine curiosity to know who this person is in front of you? And I would offer, Evan, in terms of, you know, whether you want to say, I think I'm right, that there are other phrases, right, that could indicate my values in this are so strong. And I wonder if you can see where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the level of values, we can actually really connect with each other. It's the strategies that we're going to disagree with. So if you can name a value that the other person can connect with, you know, there's a starting point for the conversation. Maybe the value is fairness, or maybe the value is like a true understanding of what's really happening, you know, because like Kim said, you know, yeah, we can start on that point. And then it's a matter of, let's talk about what the situation would look like.
Germani, how do you feel about this one? Germani is director of the Center for Employment Opportunities in Rochester.
So for me personally, I feel like when it comes to handling conflict, it requires a deep level of empathy and patience. For me, I always try to understand the root cause of the conflict by actively listening and approach each situation with a level of commitment and transparency and also fairness to the individual in which I'm dealing with the conflict. I think that the process is both professional and personal. For me, it's rooted in my faith and belief in reconciliation. And so, therefore, I aim to foster environments that prioritize healing and growth over division. But to Dr. May's point and Kim's point, I think it's also how I show up in those situations when I'm dealing with conflict, because there are a layer of things that we deal with on a daily basis, right? So making sure that I'm not bringing those to the table, I'm able to put those aside, keep an open mind about the situation, and hear from the other individual's perspective as well.
How effective are you at doing that?
Pretty effective.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't always work.
I'm
not.
Like,
do have to be intentional in how you approach it. And as you said, genuine, very genuine and authentic in how you approach the situation. So,
Milo, you get to back clean up here.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just going to probably reflect back something that I've heard everybody say. And also you, Evan, when you were talking about people kind of moving into separate neighborhoods to, avoid talking to each other. Just the importance, and this is part of, again, the restorative practices work that we've been doing with the center at Brockport, is focusing on relationship building, on community building. Part of what's coming out of this conversation for me is the hardest places to have these conversations are either with people you don't know, and so you just project onto them all of these things that you can project onto them because you don't know them, or with the people who are closest to you because it feels dangerous to go there and to potentially disrupt that relationship even more, or it feels dangerous to yourself. And in both of those places, not with every random stranger, but the people maybe that you work with but don't know, you can do intentional practices around building community and building relationships. If there's a whole community of people you think is a problem, you don't know them at all, there are some things you can do to start intentionally building some relationship that doesn't involve talking about politics, but to, you know, and with the people you're closest to, same thing. You can invest time and energy in maintaining the parts of that relationship that are important to you so that it is a little bit easier to show up in those ways. Like, how we show up is totally relational too, right? And it's hard to just say, well, I'm going to calm myself and be who I want to be when I get into this, you know, environment. But if you build the environment, the chances that you're going to be able to show up and be curious, I think, are a lot higher.
Well, as we get ready to wrap here, one more time, Shira May, as president and CEO of the Center for Dispute Settlement, classes, resources, et cetera, where do people learn more?
Yeah, well, thank you for having us. We love talking about conflict. That's what we do. That's our gig, and we enjoy it. We sometimes say we follow the heat. We sit in the fire, and so we're here to support you. Check out our website for our upcoming classes and trainings and workshops. If you would like a mediation session, we have community mediations for a low fee. You can fill out a form on our website. And just contact us if we can partner with your organization. We really like to create partnerships over a long-term period where we can figure out solutions that will stay with you over time.
Online where?
CDSADR.org.
CDSADR.org. Thank you, everyone, for this. You know, I'm thinking about some of what Milo was saying about, you know, actual danger and, you know, real threat to individuals. And this is not an easy time. If you're not feeling actually safe with people in your life, that is one thing. And I would never tell you, well, just, you know, you'll figure it out. But if you're feeling like relationships are withering and they don't have to, and you could have a better discourse, then I feel like we can do better. And I feel like that there's a lot of tools and resources. I want to thank you for providing them. So no judgment, anyone listening. Much love to everyone. Shira May, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Kim Reich, Director of Ontario Yates CDS. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Adam.
Milo Oberon. Dr. Oberon's Professor and Chair of the Women and Gender Studies Department at SUNY Brockport. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jarmani Dozier, Director of the Center for Employment Opportunities in Rochester. Thank you.
Thank you.
More connections coming up.